On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Sinofsky is out, Google is in, and big data is everywhere. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 19, recorded November 19th, 2012. Have you been to Kansas? This episode of Twyatt is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second one free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Social Media Solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with Social Media Solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit. I'm your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by an all-star, stellar, packed panel, starting as always with my brother-in-arms, really, Mr. Brian Chi from ThinLinks and the University of Hawaii. Brian, wait. You were with me in D.C. last week. Where are you now?
I'm actually in Gainesville, Florida. I'm with Kurt. And Kurt and I are desperately trying to go and pound out some more chapters in our new book on cloud security.
So have Chibert will travel, basically, is what we're talking about.
Or according to DualWolf, it's the Chibert's Microsoft Store World Tour 2012.
That's right. And we'll get to that a little bit later, explain why you're visiting pretty much every Microsoft store in the world. But first, I want to go to the man who is about, what, 10, 5, 15 feet away from you, Mr. Curtis Franklin.
Thank you, Padre. I would say we're probably about 10 feet apart. We're trying for that wonderful sense of sonic isolation that makes it seem like we're a little more far-flung than we are. It's a cool gray day here in Florida. Perfect day to be inside in front of the cameras talking to the Twyatt universe.
And, of course, Curtis is one of the wonderful people that you'll meet at Enterprise Efficiency. Let's go to another man who you already know, Mr. Oliver Rist from InfoWorld. Oliver's coming to us from a low-res camera somewhere in a basement in Seattle where he's got a modem connection to the Internet, I believe. Oliver, how are things going?
Bite me. It's going good. It's going good. Thank you. Except for the rain. It's been raining for 6 days, and it's supposed to rain for another 7 days. So just if anyone out there has a job for a tech-savvy communication specialist anywhere else but the Puget Sound area, I can be had for a low six-figure salary, some good stock options, and a very generous relocation package. Just letting you know.
Yeah,
put it out.
I hear Hawaii is hiring, right? Right, Chibert? Hawaii's got plenty of tech sector jobs. Okay. Oh, now we have brought in a super secret special guest to talk about the topic of the day, and that, if we can get his, there we go, is Mr. There Andrew Brust. He is from Blue Badge Insights. He is the big data expert for ZDNet. Andrew, where are you? And, well, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I am in Manhattan. I'm actually, people won't believe me when I say this, but I'm on the 72nd floor of the Empire State Building. There is a killer view through that window behind me, but I've got the blinds down because otherwise I would just be totally washed out. So it's a little bit of a tease, but there you go. And it's not raining here. Everything's good. It's a little chilly, though.
You have surprisingly good connectivity for the 72nd floor of the Enterprise and of the Empire State Building. Now, let's get into the heart of the Enterprise Bite. Now, I know that this story has been discussed ad nauseum. I'm sorry if you've heard it before, but it really is a big thing for the Enterprise, and that is Stephen Sinofsky being out at Microsoft. Now, here are some of the basics in case you haven't heard about this story. Sinofsky started with Microsoft in 1989 as a software developer. He became president of Windows and Windows Live. He was not known to be a team player. In fact, he was known to be kind of petty and vindictive by some accounts. Ballmer wanted a more company-wide evaluation in place, not Sinofsky's. He liked pitching divisions against each other, making Windows fight off Office, making Office fight off Live, making Live fight off Mobile. And, they want to move to a more holistic view of what Microsoft is and what they do. And so Sinofsky, after the Windows 8 launch, was summarily released. We have people here in our panel who actually have a lot of experience with Microsoft. So I want to kick it off to you first, Oliver. What's your take on the departure of Sinofsky and what this means for Microsoft?
What does it mean for Microsoft? Well, Sinofsky had a certain style, so to put it nicely. I have not read any of the stuff that you're putting down as fact. That they have a new vision, that they're trying to get rid of his personality. He was very successful. Admittedly, yeah, he had. I don't think a lot of people liked him, but he did. He did his job well. And the fact that he's leaving puts a woman I have not heard of yet in the driver's seat. So, frankly, the Windows division is, in my opinion, the hardest division of Microsoft to run successfully because it looks like they're bread and butter, but it really isn't. So, and staying on the cutting edge of that is not an easy job. So I think it's going to add some uncertainty in that department for Microsoft, and especially since they just released 8. So over the next couple of years, I think it's going to be a bit of a question mark of how that's going to proceed as Windows keeps maturing.
Right. So Julie Larson Green took over the Windows division, and she's a relative unknown. I mean, people aren't really sure what kind of managerial experience she brings to something as big as the Windows division. They're not really sure if she's got the engineering background that she would need for something like this. Andrew, you also had some insights about Microsoft. What do you think about the departure? And again, what do you think about what this might mean for Windows as a whole going into the future?
Sure. Well, the departure has a couple of factors involved. I would take issue with the idea that Stephen Sinofsky was not a team player. He very much was, but he played with his team. Other words, he had his whole group doing amazing things, and he would be their best advocate, and was very modest, honestly, about praise that came when the team did well. Let's not forget, this is the guy who took Vista and made it into Windows 7. Which was no small feat. At this point, we're between product cycles, and if the guy was going to move on, now's the time to do it because planning for Windows 9 starts right now. All of this makes sense, but yes, there was definitely a kind of rivalry in terms of his style, and there was also a great deal of secrecy in terms of how he approached the market and influencers and customers and partners. And it is quite possible that some of that caught up to him. One thing to keep in mind about Larson Green, or maybe two things, she does have a background as a developer. So on the engineering side, I think she probably does have the chops. She's only in charge of engineering, if I have that right. Ms. Reller on the other side will be handling marketing. You'll notice neither one has been promoted to the title of president, though, and it seems unlikely to me that the Windows division would continue presidentless. So they're both reporting directly to Mr. Ballmer, and my guess is that there could be another adjustment made to that particular chain of command. But right now we have really his two top lieutenants running the show, so I don't expect huge, huge changes anytime soon.
Right. I want to bring this over to Curtis. Something that I've heard has been that this was something in the making, that they knew they wanted to go in a different direction, but they didn't want to do it before Windows 8 was released. However, listening to Andrew, does it sound likely that Microsoft would not have planned for succession, would not have had a president ready to go if they actually knew they were going to get rid of Sinofsky after Windows 8?
Well, it does seem, interesting that they didn't have someone ready to go on the day. This actually reminds me an awful lot of something that happened before in Microsoft's history. For those who might have been around long enough to remember it, the day that Windows Vista shipped, Jim Alchin, who had been the chief designer of Windows Vista, his retirement became effective. And so this is not the first time that we've seen the head of a Windows division leave either on the day of an operating system release or shortly thereafter. You know, Microsoft is in the process of making it seem like the surest route out of the top job in Windows operating system management is to actually successfully ship a new version of the operating system.
Yeah. Now, Chieber, what do you think about that? Because there have been a lot of people who have, well, they've dumped on the rumor mill. They've talked about Sanofsky being all those things that we just described. But we see this all the time, right? Whenever you get a top exec, someone who is particularly driven, someone who has seen a lot of success, there always seems to be that backbiting. Once they're out the door, then the claws come out. And, oh, he did this once, and I hate when he did that, and he destroyed this product and that division. Is this par for the course? Or, I mean, is it symptomatic of something that was wrong at Microsoft?
No, it's not something wrong with Microsoft. You have to be pretty ruthless if you're controlling literally tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of product. Like, for instance, I was working with a three-star admiral on a very, very large project, and it was literally almost $500 million worth of upgrades. And it takes an awful lot out of you. You know, you got to remember that a corporation is not a democracy. It is at best a theocracy, and most cases it has to be someone that is worth and willing to do empire building, because they need to make a lot of really hard calls. So it's easy for everybody to go and throw arrows and spears at Mr. Sanofsky. He might have been a jerk. That's his prerogative. But the bottom line is, if you aren't at least a little bit of a jerk or aren't willing to go and make some really tough decisions, then you're not going to be the person you want running $100 million, $200 million, $500 million project.
Okay, we're getting back to this. Oliver, I want to throw this over to you. There are comparisons in the chat room right now of, well, what about Sanofsky and Forstall? Or even what about Sanofsky and Jobs, Sanofsky and Gates? Is this true? In order to run an empire like that, do you need to be a jerk? Do you need to be someone who people don't like but gets results?
Well, I don't think the guy was necessarily unliked. I mean, I agree with Bruce. I'm sure he was not liked by the departments that he was competing with, but his own people probably liked him a lot because he did protect them. So you got to look at Microsoft's evolution, right? They're suddenly, I think their population, their employee population has doubled in the last 12 years. This is a company that's evolving. Every corporation has to evolve. IBM did it in the early 80s. It's a time when the culture is going to change. They're not working as closely together, department and department, as they used to. So yeah, there's going to be some infighting, and there's going to be some adjustment as people vie for budget, vie for people, vie for control. And he was very good at that. I think we're making a little bit too much out of why he left. I mean, Bob Mu left the Windows Server division rather abruptly. Stuff like that happens. These are very high-powered people, and if they don't see an immediate career path at Microsoft, or they get a much better offer, they're going to leave, and they're going to leave fast. And I wouldn't blame Sanofsky if that happened to him for not, you know, telegraphing it 3 months in advance. That's not something that that you want to do. So, and Microsoft, by the way, the no president thing, they are very careful about who they put in that slot. Windows Server was president-less for almost a year, I think, before they put somebody new in there. So maybe we're making a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill.
Andrew, let me throw this to you, because there's a comment in the chat room that from Zero Glitch, who says, I don't think it's necessary for CEOs to be jerks in order to be effective, but it's absolutely necessary for them to know when to ignore what's being said to them and just do what they know is right for the company. That makes people dislike you sometimes, right? I mean, especially people not within your division.
Yeah, I think unless you're the kind of person that makes the trains run on time, then they won't run on time. And so a lot of what people found objectionable about Stephen Sanofsky's style was, in fact, required. There was some abrasiveness, though, that perhaps wasn't absolutely necessary. And, you know, we don't know this all as fact. We know it from kind of innuendo and from chatter with people who work for the company. But it's interesting we mentioned Bob Muglia because a number of people feel that he left because of disagreements with Sinofsky, as a matter of fact. So, look, there's charisma and there's leadership necessary that's not going to make everybody feel good all the time. I think Bill Gates was an example of all of that. But there is kind of a tough love aspect that that means that at some point the rivalry, the adversarial nature of things needs to be muted a bit. And I think some people felt that Sinofsky didn't master that balance very well.
All right, I want to step away a little bit from the rumor mill because most of the story, as all four of you have pointed out, is a lot of rumor. We don't have a lot of fact other than the fact that Sinofsky isn't working for Microsoft anymore, at least not as president. Let's go into a story that we have a bit more meat on, and that is the projection for PC sales figures. Right here in front of me, I've got an Acer W700 tablet. This is an actual Windows tablet, so it's not a Surface. This is a notebook with a Core i7 in a nice little tablet format. It's wonderful. I actually really like it. I like what they've done with it. I find it usable, but the sales figures that we're seeing now show that maybe Windows 8 isn't as big of a hit as they were thinking it might be. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Windows 8 itself is DOA. But you've got Gartner and IDC revising their forecast for PC sales down into 2016. What do you think about this? I mean, Windows 8 we knew was a transition. It was a move from the old beige box PC into something that was a bit more unified, unified platforms between laptops, desktops, phones, and tablets. What do we expect to see out of Windows 8 in, say, the next 6 months? Cheebert, I want to start with you.
Well, my favorite thing to harp about on Windows 8 is it is a better architected platform. It's architected to be able to be separated. The GUI and the kernel can be separated much more easily for the very first time. And that's going to be key towards Microsoft being able to go and move towards a lot more different platforms. Like, for instance, my favorite is Embedded. Embedded XP is very, very old and is supposedly end of life, but is still the core of a lot of things like gas pumps, digital displays and things like that because it was a true embedded platform. With Windows 8, because you can install – because the developers can go to a GUI-less versions of Windows 8, just the kernel, you can do some very, very interesting things if you only have the kernel and then use a remote management platform to manage a large number of these. So it could get very interesting, especially as it spreads out into a lot more platforms than just the traditional Wintel.
Now, Curtis, this kind of flies in the face of what a lot of people have been saying about Windows 8, which is, oh, well, Enterprise is going to stick with 7, or Enterprise is migrating to 7. But if it is a better architected platform, and it really is, I mean, aside from the GUI, aside from some of the choices they made on user interface, it's a better operating system. Is that going to change its future in the Enterprise, or do you still see it as sort of a non-starter?
I'm not sure it's going to be a non-starter. I think that what we are going to see is some more fragmentation in terms of the client business within the enterprise. On desktops, now whether that's represented by a classic desktop box or a laptop used primarily on a desktop, I think that Windows 8 is going to have a long, slow rollout. I don't see lots of enterprises diving into that. And frankly, I haven't talked to any CIO who says that his company is planning to make a very rapid Windows 8 migration across the board. What we are going to see is a lot of companies hoping to go to Windows 8 for their tablets. There are advantages to Windows 8, especially Windows 8 Pro, when it comes to tablet operating systems for the enterprise. So I think what we're going to see is a lot of companies going to Windows 8 on the tablets that they use, whether it's tablets they buy or tablets that they recommend and allow through a BYOD program. while sticking with Windows 7 on the desktop. The big reason there, frankly, is training. Think about all the companies that are still using Windows Vista, Windows XP on their desktop. The big reason there is that they have solutions that work and they don't want to go to the expense of training their users on a new operating system. That goes double for Windows 8 simply because of the vast changes that the new interface brings. Now, people will say, what about the Windows 7 fallback in terms of interface? It's there, but it's not the first thing that comes up, and users can still get into the Windows 8 native interface, and once they do that, the calls to support go through the roof.
Oliver, what do you think about that? So that is actually an aspect that a lot of people don't think of when they consider migration strategies, and that is, if Windows 8 is close enough to Windows 7 or close enough to Windows XP, you don't have to retrain an entire workforce to learn how to use Office apps on an iPad. And in fact, if the Surface has Office baked into it, that is a huge boost for deciding to go with Surface. Is that a factor in rollout? I mean, are they really pushing at enterprise with that little bit of strategy?
No. No. So you guys are kind of missing one of the advantages of Windows 8, which I guess hasn't been hyped very much. Number one, I'm not surprised that you can't talk to a CEO who's saying, I'm going to jump on it. You never can talk to a CEO at this stage who's saying he's going to jump on any new version of Windows. That just doesn't happen. Right. They always were a lot slow, right? So that's factor one. Factor two, what makes Windows 8 as sexy as it is, in my opinion, it's not out yet as far as I can tell, right? There's going to be a hardware component to this, especially for the desktop version that we haven't seen yet. They're trying to redesign how we interface with a computer, which I think is very visionary for Microsoft. But if they pull it off, that puts them right out in front in as far as innovation goes. And number two, they've redesigned how you build applications for Windows. They've made it a whole lot easier. Go look at Visual Studio 2012. A Windows 8 app can be HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript, and that's a fully functional front end Windows 8 and Metro and Windows application. It'll run the same on the desktop. It'll run the same on a tablet. It'll run the same on a phone. That's huge for enterprises who do custom dev, and there's a lot of them. Suddenly, it's a lot simpler. It's a lot better supported, and it really handles that BYOD thing. That's something I can't see any other OS platform doing, right? So as soon as I think enterprises look at the dev cycle of it, you're going to see a lot more people wanting to go to 8. It's just easier and way cheaper to maintain and build apps.
Andrew, I want to give you the last word on this.
Sure.
How big is that a part of the Windows 8 rollout? I mean, that's something that the consumer is absolutely not looking at. A lot of people in business, a lot of people in enterprise, a lot of geeks really do look at that. They look at the ability to, say, write once, compile many times across platforms. They look at the ease of dev use. They look at things like being able to custom make your OS for your application. Those are huge. But when do we actually see people jumping on that? I mean, how long is it going to take before we have the dev community and we have the enterprise community making the realization that there's something in Windows 8 that they could not get with 7, they cannot get with XP, and indeed it will make future efficiencies that much better?
Right. Yeah, no, there's a couple of things to consider, I think, especially going back to your first point about Gartner's projections of PC sales. Let's not forget that, one of the planks of the policy for Windows 7 and by virtue of that for Windows 8 was to make sure that it ran on older machines really well. Vista didn't have that problem, if you recall. But 7 and 8 absolutely had this all kinds of backward compatibility, which was elegant, but it didn't exactly drive a hardware refresh. I think one thing that will drive a hardware refresh is the fact that Windows 8 is a very touch-oriented operating system. I'm hearing reports out in the wild of people using it on laptops that don't have touch screens, and they're getting fingerprints all over their screen because they keep moving to touch it. And I do think there's something to that. I think it's going to drive a hardware refresh on the laptop side. To get to your dev question specifically, there are legions of .NET developers out there in the world building corporate applications. They have these skill sets. .NET is 10 years old. This is a very mature platform. By the way, I'm one of those developers. And you know, to move over to the iPad, it's a completely different skill set. It's a completely different tool set. And by the way, it is a much more Spartan, far less productive tool set. That doesn't really matter if you want to go where the money is. And, you know, if you're an app developer, I suppose, then iPad's the place to go. But if you're building line of business applications and you want to be able to do that, as we were just discussing, not just on the conventional desktop, but on tablets and on phones, although the Windows Phone 8 platform is really not identical to Windows 8 proper, there is a lot of commonality. There's a certain API affinity now. And there's a whole efficiency of scale with existing skill sets that nobody else can bring to the table. So I absolutely agree. That's a huge value proposition for Windows 8. And I also agree that no version of Windows rolls out quickly. You know, there are all kinds of companies just rolling out 7 now. This is how Windows goes. It takes 2 to 3 years after release to manufacturing before large enterprises roll it out. And that's just because there's a cost associated with rolling out. And that's also why I think it makes sense to say that we will see Windows 8 on tablets, because those are new acquisitions as opposed to an operating system refresh on existing infrastructure.
I think the best thing we can say here is Windows 8 will have to wait and see. I do want to move on to the next story we've got in the Enterprise Bite. And this is a story that we've actually very closely followed on Twyte because, well, we're all geeks, but also because of the promise it has for, well, what we do for enterprise communications, enterprise networking, and business development. That is that Google Fiber has officially started rolling out in Kansas. So they had announced it previously after they said that they would be rolling out in Kansas. They had announced the pricing, which was $70 a month for gigabit internet. That's up and down. 1 terabyte of Google Cloud storage and no caps. Or $120 a month for that internet service plus high definition TV. They also had the option to pay $300 to get the fiber run to your house and then get 5 megabits down, 1 megabit up for the rest of your life with no additional fee ever. Fantastic shakeup in the industry. I mean, it showed people, wow, if Google could deploy this for these prices, why can't a Comcast or why can't a Verizon? Now they have now that they have actually lit it and people are getting their service to their homes, there are a series of stories about some entrepreneurs that are buying houses within the fiberhood, Google's rollout area, and turning them into either vacation places for people who want a lot of bandwidth or sort of little startup zones, places where startup businesses can come and plug in, get a lot of bandwidth, something akin to the startup houses and hostels that we have here in San Francisco. My question to the panel, and this is an open question, is could something like this really redefine how we think about a technology hub? Right now, it's the Silicon Valley because there's such a clustering of companies. But in the age of enterprise communications and the internet, couldn't you bring your startup to the middle of Kansas, to a small house, a basement with a couple of servers, and run it just as successfully off of the Google backbone? Open question.
You ever been to Kansas?
I have. I don't want to slam Kansas, but yes, I have.
I think you can do it. And I think the fact that you can do it is why we're starting to see some forward-looking communities do something like this on their own. Chattanooga, Tennessee, for example, has undergone a 20-year renaissance program that has led to them offering this kind of bandwidth. So the fact is, yes, in most cases, you can move a business anywhere, and I think you're going to see more and more communities start to follow the lead established by Google in offering bandwidth like this as something to attract businesses to their communities.
Now, Chibert, you already do something like this. You run one of the world's largest independent testing labs, and you do it from an island in the middle of the Pacific. And the only reason why you can do that is because you have a relatively fat pipe back to the mainland. So, I mean, how far-fetched is this? Could Kansas become a technology hub because people have ultra-high-speed, ultra-low-cost bandwidth?
I really don't see why not. There's bandwidth nowadays is, you know, that's just one of the bread and butter pieces. You know, if you're doing a startup, that's what you need. You need connectivity. Everything's going to the cloud. And as long as the Department of Justice doesn't trash us, this ought to be great. Now, keep in mind, Kansas has Lenexa, Kansas, which is already a tech center. Quite a few of the original startups in the networking industry and the communications industry was in Lenexa. Yeah, I know. I have been to Kansas also, Beatmaster, and it's the reason why I sent a dozen pineapples to my friend in Lenexa in the dead of winter, and I got a tech support call on how to cut pineapple in the middle of the winter. But getting back onto the topic, yeah, bandwidth is a big deal. And with California doing stupid laws and making it a lot more expensive to do business in Northern California, corporations are going to start looking for other places. And startups don't have a ton of money. So what are they going to do? Lenexa, Kansas, and so forth. Man, the cost of living is really low. Honolulu, it's insanely high. And the only reason why I have that kind of bandwidth is because of the National Science Foundation, and I'm sitting at a university. If I was going to try and do this as a private individual within the Honolulu metropolitan area, I would not be able to do it because bandwidth is too freaking expensive. Honolulu was definitely one of those cities that did a full court press trying to convince Google that we should be one of the Google Fiber cities. Unfortunately, Kansas did a better job.
Now, Andrew, the Zero Glitch in the chat room, again, has a really good insight, something that I was going to get to in a bit. And that is these areas that have been hit particularly hard in real estate, like Kansas City, you can buy a decent house for between $38,000 to $50,000. In fact, the man in the story bought it for $48,000 and have really high-speed internet. And that man is actually renting it out to a couple of startups, so it pays his mortgage. Is this something that you would consider doing? I mean, I want to go on a tangent a little bit. If you had $30,000 to invest, would you buy a house in the middle of America where Google had just deployed high-speed internet and will try to make something out of it?
Well, we'd have to role play a little bit there. I'm born and raised in Manhattan, and I'm more than a little bit of a parochial snob. So no, me personally, probably not. I'm proud of the way cities work in that there's a huge concentration of talent and that, you know, customers and providers are usually walking distance from each other. I think that's a big deal. On the other hand, that can work against businesses and economic development in a couple of ways. First of all, real estate is humongously expensive here, of course. And second of all, new technology and especially bandwidth technology deploys very slowly. We don't have utility poles in Manhattan. We have conduit under the asphalt. And the company that runs that conduit, nobody knows this or very few people know this. It's actually a division of Verizon. And they've been known on occasion to say, I'm sorry, but the conduit is full, which has a certain anti-competitive slant to it. So it can be tricky. You complimented me on the quality of the connection from the Empire State Building. That's because Verizon Fios is now in the building, but that took years to happen. Before that, all we had was a choice of Time Warner Cable, which was very expensive and slow, and Verizon DSL, which was cheaper but even slower. So it goes in phases. We catch up, but then we fall behind. And if you're in a relatively low populated place, especially if there's been a depression in the real estate market, that makes for an opportunity. And if it's not so densely populated, that makes it much less expensive to in terms of a capital investment to deploy any kind of high bandwidth. So I think there's a yin and a yang aspect to this. I'll stay in the city, though.
Oliver, I want to give you the last word because there are a bunch of people in Kansas who hate you right now. But when we look at something like this, this is really a disruptive technology. This is a disruptive service because they have priced themselves so far below what Comcast and Verizon and Time Warner and the other telcos have done. Do you see this more as a move that Google's making to force the other telcos to shape up their business, to get it more in line with what it actually costs to deliver high-speed bandwidth? Or is this the start of a trend for Google? Are they going to start deploying high-bandwidth connectivity around all the data centers they have in the United States?
I doubt it. As far as moving my business to Kansas, forget about the fact that I'm much like Andrew, I'm a New Yorker. If I was going to move it anywhere, I would move it there. if it was anybody besides Google doing this, I would consider moving my business to some, you know, godforsaken spot. But that company, and I'm not speaking as an ex-Microsoft, I'm speaking as an ex-journalist, has this history of doing fantastic things like this, and then suddenly they get bored with it, or you find out that the ultra-low price was being operated on at a loss, and it can't be sustained, things like that. Yeah, I would actually go with your first concept, where maybe they're doing this to pressure the rest of the telecom folks to clean up their act. I mean, I had to work with Verizon when I was in New York also, trying to light up buildings, and Lord are those guys backwards, right? So maybe pressuring them to change the way that they're playing the game, it helps Google in the long run, and certainly scaring the telcos is something I'd be in favor of. But seeing Google do this on a large scale across all their data centers, I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank Oliver for being on. I know that you have to depart here, so I want to give you a chance to tell us about anything you're working on or anything you want to bring attention to.
Let's see. Still InfoWorld. I think I got a bunch of Windows Reviews Essentials and Office 365 coming. I'm going to put those two together, talk about the entire Microsoft Small Business Package. You can look for that. And other than that, I'm just desperately trying to see just a sliver of sunlight here and planning my move back home to the East Coast where normal people live.
Well, we won't be able to help you with the sunlight, but we are sending you a high-definition camera so that in future episodes of Twight, we'll be able to see just you and all your HD glory.
Oh, you want to see all the pores on my face. Great. Okay. Awesome.
Oliver, thank you very much. As always, we appreciate your contribution. You always bring great discussion and a little bit of the cranky geek spirit that we need to you know, stay straight.
Thank you very much. I'll see you next time.
Now, when we built our studio here at the Brick House in Petaluma, we didn't want a traditional PBX. We wanted something that was more in line with what we were doing with our broadcasting, and that is moving our services to the cloud. We didn't want a bunch of lines running up from the basement. We didn't want a clunky PBX system littering up a corner of our storage area. And so when Russell, our IT guy, told us that we would be able to deploy a full-featured phone system based on the cloud, well, it was a no-brainer. And that's why we went with RingCentral. Now, RingCentral has everything that you need. It's a cloud-based, zero-startup, no PBX hardware phone system that you don't need to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. That means that our producers can get their voicemail in their email. We can get our fax messages on our smartphones. We can customize the service to work for us, rather than the other way around. Now, RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. This is really a fantastic way to deploy phone services in your business because you get to grow it simply by adding another line, another $20, another user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, one more time, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's RingCentral, promo code TWIT, and we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the meat of the episode, and that is big data. Andrew, what is big data? We hear about it every once in a while. We get vague stories about why it's important, why we should have it. But what would you say to the average listener when he asks or she asks, why should I care about big data?
Well, first, definition itself. And you know, there's more than one. I find that the term is co-opted for different agendas. Sometimes there's a sort of pure mathematical definition that says if you have less data than X, then it's not big data. And then you hear about big data projects where actually the volume is a lot less than X. So a couple of different definitions. One is that you're working with mounds of data that are in the hundreds of terabytes up to the petabyte, which would be 1,024 terabytes. So you hear the term petabyte scale quite often as well. Some people believe that if you're in that range, then you're doing big data. Other folks will summon the so-called three Vs, volume, velocity, and variety. the volume we've already talked about. That's one hallmark of big data. Velocity speaks to how rapidly the data may be streaming, and it talks to the difficulty of doing analytics on that data on the one hand while it's still continuing to stream in on the other. So clearly, clickstream web companies have to deal with all kinds of clickstream data. Financial companies have to deal with all kinds of market data. Manufacturing companies, not everyone thinks of this, but they'll need to deal with all kinds of sensor data coming off of equipment on the manufacturing floor. So those are the three V's. My definition is if you're doing analytics on data, oh, and I'm sorry, I forgot variety, the third V. Variety speaks to the idea that the data is not neatly organized in columns and rows as relational databases are, but instead could involve documents, digital video, digital audio, or database data that just doesn't have a consistent schema from record to record to record. But I think the best definition is that if you're working with data and doing analytics on it, such that conventional operational database tools are not practical in terms of getting that work done, then you're probably in the zone of big data where you need special technologies, special tools. You need to be able to scale out. You need to be able to use distributed computing to make sure that your tasks can execute in parallel. And there's a big open source technology called Hadoop that is a big part of that. And that's, I think, the best working definition. Some people feel that if you're doing anything with Hadoop at all, then it's big data, even if you're dealing with a database the size of an Access database. As long as you're using Hadoop, you're in the big data zone. I would probably take issue with that. But you will see different definitions be conflated. You will see the term being kind of diluted, and it's a little tricky.
Cheever, you've been working with big data ever since before it was called big data, and that you've been building these networks for gathering information from sensors. And this is disparate information. Again, you know, not relational. It was something where we just had these huge data sets that would then be processed and turned into something that was consumable. Why is there all of a sudden a big interest in big data for, say, non-government entities all of a sudden?
I actually am not sure. The whole term big data actually caught me by surprise. But like you said, academia has been dealing with big data for a very, very long time. Long enough that some of my big data is sitting on 9-track tapes that we're desperately trying to find an old drive so we can convert. One of the projects I work on, I sent Jason the URL. It's aloha.manoa.hawaii.edu, and it actually drills down into the Aloha Cabled Observatory. We actually bring up time series data from 24 kilohertz and 96 kilohertz stereo hydrophones, including seismic sensors, temperature, water chemistry, you name it. The amount of data we stream is just staggering. We are definitely in the multi-petabyte range. I'm trying to get funding now to build a 10-petabyte Blu-ray optical archiving system. Now, what's nice for us is that we actually will take this data, and we're more interested in either events or we're interested in what's happening at a certain time and date. So a lot of our metadata concentrates around that. But in addition, we also try to correlate this with different pieces of data like high-resolution webcam, salinity, flow meters, and things like that. So we're actually taking a really hard look at using a product called Splunk, which I think we're going to have on a future episode one of these days. And that'll allow us to go and synchronize a lot of this time series data. I have not seen any really good examples of things to deal with time series data other than Splunk. But everybody keeps telling me I need to take a lot more interest in Hadoop, so I'll probably head there. And the URL is aloha.manoa, manoa.hawaii.edu. Jason, I actually stuck the URL into the rundown schedule in the chat box. It actually goes to ACO-SSDS.SOEST.hawaii.edu. www.hawaii.edu. And I'm going to drop that into the chat room in just a second.
There we go.
Thank you.
It never came through on chat, or at least I didn't see it, but I have it up now.
Sorry. Yeah, and I'm going to throw that in the chat room so the chat room can have it. You can actually pull some of our live data off that. And that's actually undersea observatory 3 miles down. So that's the kind of big data I deal with. Now, from the
let me go back to Andrew real quick. Andrew, yeah. Would you consider this big data? I mean, with all the different sensors that they're pulling from, with all the different sources of information that they're using on this network, would this fit the definition of big data?
I think it would fit a number of the definitions that I had cited before. Sensor data, petabyte scale stuff. Absolutely. And by the way, I'd love to talk to Brian some more. The stuff that I'm doing for ZDNet, I end up talking an awful lot with vendors. It's a little tougher to find people who are actually applying the technology. So without a doubt, that gets the big data blue ribbon for me right away. Splunk, by the way, is, of course, a darling big data company. They had a very successful IPO. And if I'm not mistaken, their applications actually work on top of Hadoop. So whether you know it or not, you're using Hadoop, it sounds like. actually, that sort of will segue into another point that I hope we can talk about, which is that, you know, Hadoop is a very powerful technology, but it has its own skill set that goes along with it. And lots of organizations, enterprises especially, are not really going to efficiently just pivot to the Hadoop skill set. So applications that sit on top of Hadoop and make it more usable to different audiences and markets are going to be, I think, what really brings big data mainstream.
Curtis, let me throw to you here. When we talk about big data at Interop, we're always talking about Splunk because Splunk has been our search engine for big data. It takes all the logs of all the equipment across our entire network, and it turns into something that we can understand. It turns it into something that we can drill into. And, it takes data sets that would be otherwise way too big for us to consider and makes it consumable. So when we have a company like Splunk, which has become a darling in the enterprise, when we have terms like big data being thrown around to have digestible bits of information, what does that do for the need to incorporate big data in a deployment? I mean, when you're looking at creating a new network, or when you're looking at creating a new strategy, or when you're looking at creating new data points, what does the contemporary network and enterprise need to consider to have big data functionality?
Well, I think one of the things that companies need to consider is their storage and their entire storage networking architecture. Remember a few years ago when it became obvious that companies were collecting all kinds of data on their users? A lot of us said, why would you collect information that you don't have a way to analyze? Well, with big data, we now have a way to analyze that. Big data really is about taking all of the data from a number of different sources, data of different types, and turning it into useful information. For companies, that means that they need to have ways to get that data into the servers where the application logic lives, ways of storing the data so that it can be used in a timely fashion, and ways of presenting the information that results. I'll give you a couple of quick examples that I think are important. One is that big data is one of the things that allows companies to analyze all that's going on in social networks. One of the companies that has sponsored this particular show is SAP with their social networking analysis stuff. That's an example of big data, taking information on customers from all of the different social networks, turning it into useful information for the marketing team. Couple of other things. We now have a television show all about big data. If anyone on Thursday nights has watched Person of Interest, it's all about The Machine, a giant surveillance system that looks at data from all kinds of disparate sources and brings it together to reach conclusions about individuals, to predict terrorism and acts of crime. That's big data. Get a lot of data from different sources, data of different types, and pull it together into useful information. Once you've done that, you're into big data.
Now, Andrew, what do we need to do to our network designs in order to accommodate the petabytes of data? I mean, is there something, are we ready to go with it now, or do traditional networks need to be modified in any way, shape, or form in order to do things like, you know, what we see in the movies and Person of Interest, or what we see with studies that the government may do on ocean data? What is the big hardware technical challenge that we need to address before we start considering big data?
The big challenge really is less the network, and I would say more storage per se. And that's one of the reasons Hadoop is so popular. It has something called the Hadoop distributed file system for handling these large volumes of data, for replicating that data so that if any of the servers in a big Hadoop cluster goes down, your data is still there. And perhaps most important, HDFS uses the local direct attached commodity drives in the servers rather than relying on big enterprise networked storage. And in fact, when it goes to actually work on the data itself to do the processing, which we haven't talked about too much yet, but one of the things it does is it tries to give the processing work to a given node in the cluster that already has the data on a local disk. So in fact, it reduces burdens on the network by moving the data around the network less and allowing machines to operate on data that's stored locally. That said, as these data volumes get bigger and bigger, even HDFS is not going to be the panacea. One of the things it does, I mentioned replication, by default, it makes two copies of everything. So for a total of three, eventually that gets to be, although it's, you know, on cheap drives and the redundancy is good, there's inefficiencies there when, you know, as soon as you have a petabyte of data, you actually need 3 petabytes of storage. So that's a little tricky. I think this is less about infrastructure adjustment. And again, I was alluding to this earlier, a lot more about skill sets. Hadoop and other big data technologies are really kind of laboratory technologies. They're not enterprise technologies. And the convergence is coming. And different companies are you know, wrapping themselves in the banner of making Hadoop enterprise friendly. But that's still got a bunch of convulsions to go through first before it's really smooth.
Andrew, before we go any further, let me ask this, because this is going to be the big question. Big data is cool. I love big data sets. I love the fact that you can pull what seems to be like magical bits of information out of a big data set. I love the network that you would have to build and the storage subsystems that you have to build. But the question that's going to keep coming back to people is, what's the ROI here? I mean, why should I invest all this money, all these resources into building up a big data system? Why should I integrate a big data strategy into my business plans? What am I going to get back in terms of competitive edge from big data that I couldn't get elsewhere?
Sure. Well, I mean, one thing to realize is, even before the advent of the term big data and the actual activity of working with big data, you know, we've had this thing called business intelligence, and before that it was called decision support for a long time. So the power of doing analytics on business and the power, I actually loved the name decision support, even though that never really enjoyed much favoritism, because that's what the technology is about. It's about mining through the raw material of data in your transactional databases and learning something about how your business really works instead of doing it all on intuition. That can lead to better decisions. It can also create a kind of, you know, frenzy that everybody says they're making data-driven decisions just for the heck of it. So it's got to be genuine and authentic. But when it is, you get decisions that are better. Now companies that are dealing with really large volumes of data, the financial services, the web and internet companies, certainly the social media companies, or people that need to pay attention to social media sentiment, they're going to have, I think, highly demonstrable ROI right away. They may not even be able to express it mathematically, but there's going to be a kind of there's going to be a kind of urgency that if we're not looking at this data, we're going to be behind. And, you know, conversely, a lot of companies, if they're the first to market where they're making good use of that data, then they're going to be in a good place. A good example are the manufacturing companies. So I referenced this earlier. Equipment on the floor has all kinds of sensors that are putting out all kinds of readings, numerous readings per microsecond in some cases. Now, typically and historically, what was done with that data was it was simply monitored for anything abnormal. And you know, an alarm would go off. Think of it as an alarm system, if you like. But the data wasn't saved. Well, now with big data technology, we can save that data. We can analyze it. And what you're finding, and I talked to some folks at General Electric Intelligent Systems, who explained that this data is actually being used to build predictive models so that instead of merely finding out that equipment on the floor has failed, they can predict when it will fail. And they can preemptively replace that equipment without having to hit the crisis of a shift where the equipment's gone down and now, you know, we're losing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars per hour because of all the stuff that we're not making.
So wait, Andrew, so ultimately what you're talking about here is you're talking about using massive data sets to build models and models that are hyper accurate because they are taking data from so many disparate sources. But my question would be this. The way that you make it useful is to be able to tweak a data set, to be able to say, okay, well, if the data set says this and I want this outcome, it means I have to change these variables. How real world is that? I mean, how much can we actually think that that's going to work? Actually, let me throw this to Chibert. Chibert, again, working in academia, you've dealt with people who are trying to do this all the time. And working with the government and sensor networks, you see these huge sets of data, and they're always trying to interpret it. But just because you have the big data and just because you have the tools to interpret it, can you necessarily make that jump into then being able to influence the outcome?
Yeah, see, that's actually a huge problem. And that the we have all this data and you've got to analyze it. So we're constantly building models. And what we're looking for is when the data goes away from that model. And when it does, that's when you want a human involved. But more to the point, for return on investment, we're actually building models for things like hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes, and so forth. That's what it's all about. It's analyzing this huge, huge, huge data set that's oceanographic or meteorological or what have you, and being able to go and sort the needle in the haystack out of that, you know, be able to go and grab the good data, be able to go and find out when something is changing enough that it requires a human to go and look at it. And that's one of the big issues. And that's one of the reasons why I've been taking a really, really hard look at things like Splunk is how do we make it not only more available to people, but also how do we see the forest from the trees?
Curtis, what about that? So seeing the forest from the trees in the enterprise, actually taking your big data tool, be it Splunk or any other tool built upon these huge databases, what would be the best case scenario in a typical enterprise for integrating big data into their decision-making strategies?
You know, I heard an interview with an epidemiologist this week, and she said something useful about models. She said, you have to remember that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. And what bringing this additional data richness into the equation does is potentially make the models more useful. The thing that companies hate, the thing that stockholders hate, is uncertainty. And what we are able to do through the use of big data is wring a little more uncertainty out of the equations we use for our models. So what does this do for us? It allows us to take many more things into account. It allows us to bring some quantification to decision-making that had to be made entirely on what we would call our gut feelings before. And in the ideal situation, it allows our companies to make better decisions so that our employees, our customers, and our shareholders all reap the benefits of better decisions made by executives.
Andrew, back to you here. I'm sold on big data. I think a lot of geeks like myself are sold on big data because we see within the ability to process these huge chunks of information the ability to understand more about the world that's around us. And that could be anything. That could be a business decision. That could be weather predictions. That could be a tidal wave. That could be looking at factory equipment. What's the main challenge to integrating big data into a business strategy? What skills are missing? You've already spoken about the storage issues, but what right. else do we need to know about if you're going to even start to move towards using big data in your decision making?
Yeah, so the tricky part of this and the big challenge is that you've got, I mentioned business intelligence, and we're talking about big data. And in many ways, the two areas of technology really seek to do the same thing. They seek to take raw transactional data and get real information and insight out of it. You hear the word insight used all over the place, as a matter of fact. Now, the problem is these are really separate communities and they're really separate skill sets. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is. One comes more out of academia or out of companies that have the budget to just kind of support a whole team that does nothing but data analysis. And the other really comes out of organizations that are much more business focused and just need good technologies to figure out how their data works. And those two worlds need to come together. Now, in the big data world, you have this thing called Hadoop. And Hadoop works not with some query language that's well known, like SQL, which is what you use with many database technologies. But instead, you use this thing called MapReduce. And MapReduce actually involves writing two different programs in Java where imperatively you loop through every line in an input file, do something with it, organize it as keys and values, and then you write a second program that loops through the output of the first one and does some aggregation on it. And the idea that we have to write imperative code every time we need to do an analytics exercise in an academic environment, in a laboratory environment, or in the environment of a company that's very focused on data and has a lot of budget around it, that's acceptable. But in a world where people are using SQL databases and business intelligence tools, maybe are doing most of their work in Excel, that gets a lot harder. So these two worlds need to come together, and that's starting to happen in a big way. One of the biggest names in Hadoop, a company called Cloudera, just a few weeks ago at the Strata Plus Hadoop World Conference in New York, introduced a new product called Impala. And Impala actually is a distributed SQL query engine that runs over a Hadoop cluster. There are half a dozen other such mashups of SQL and Hadoop. Microsoft just announced one of their own the week before last at their PaaS Summit conference, whereby their data warehouse appliance will integrate with Hadoop and let people query it with SQL. That's what we're going to have to see for this to get truly mainstream, is for the whole world of MapReduce programming to become a low-level thing that some people will prefer to do, but it won't actually be necessary. And right now, it's just not that elegant and smooth. So we're in a transitional space right now.
I want to throw an open question to the entire panel, because there's been a few really good comments from the chat room. Again, from Zero Glitch. And he mentioned that one of the issues that he finds, because he does work with big data, is that managers can get data drunk. They get mm-hmm. so tied up to the models that they've invested so much of their resources, so much of their computing time, so much of their storage to, that they don't know when to pull away from the model and actually make the human decision. Another good issue that was brought up in the chat room is we all have a really good example of big data right now, and that is in the popularity of Nate Silver, who was able to take a big data set and make sense out of it. So where do you find that really cool balance between trusting the model, between giving the model all the data it can handle, and ultimately saying, okay, I'm confident in my model this much, I'm confident in my projections this much, and these are the decisions that we're going to make?
I think it comes back to a distinction that a lot of us who have done benchmarking have had to learn, and that's the distinction between accuracy and precision. We can have accuracy in our models at a fairly basic level, things that tend to move us off in the right direction. What a lot of people want is an unrealistic degree of precision. The fact is, every system has a certain amount, there's no better way to say it, of slop in that system, whether it's a mechanical system or a model system. What we end up doing is spending 90% of our time chasing less than 5% of useful precision that can be wrung out of it, and even worse, making decisions based on a precision that doesn't truly exist. Just because you can run an answer out to 8 or 9 decimal points or 8 or 9 positions to the right of the decimal doesn't mean that the model is truly that precise. If we can teach our executives the difference between precision and accuracy, we'll have gone a long way towards solving this particular problem.
Something else that I've always wondered is, there's an axiom in computer programming, and that is GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. And especially when we're dealing with big data, I have to wonder, what does the model do? And how do you design a model to be able to weed out the bad data? Andrew, have you heard about this before, self-correcting big data databases?
Well, look, I mean, if you're a great MapReduce programmer and a so-called data scientist, you're going to be able to create the logic that cleans up the data or sieves out the bad data, and you'll be able to do it at scale with Hadoop. That's the great thing about it. But it is absolutely possible to have lousy data. It is absolutely possible to have a lousy hypothesis on and base a model on top of that, and, you know, scale out that rather spurious result such that you end up, you know, you end up with, well, garbage out, to use your phrase. In terms of self-correcting, there are companies and there are products that are working to put logic in the analysis engines to do that. But honestly, a lot of that is very context specific. And that really kind of shines a light on something really important, which is that this isn't just about technology. You need someone who knows, who has the domain expertise to build reasonable notional hypotheses and base the models on that. And that's, you know, that's not a big data function. That is a function of somebody who knows the business and also happens to have at least a modicum of talent and aptitude with some of these technologies. Without that at the foundation, you end up with a very high-tech fallacy in terms of the models.
All right. I want to give a wrap up on this segment of big data. And the question I want to give for this last time around is, what would you tell someone, an executive, an IT executive, an IT pro, who is looking at introducing elements of big data into his network, into his infrastructure, and into his decision-making processes? Let's start with you, Brian. What's the advice you would give? What are the examples you would give? What resources would you give?
We actually had a really interesting problem recently, is how much of the data stream do we keep? Do we need to keep the entire stream, or can we just keep the models? And we decided to keep the entire data stream, even though it's going to cost us a king's ransom, because we actually had an example where our model was wrong enough that we actually had to rerun it and readjust it using the raw data. And if we didn't have the raw data, a great amount of research would have been just down the tubes. So my suggestion for anyone dealing with this is double, triple, quadruple check. Make sure before you get rid of your data sources that your models have been worked on and they have been fine-tuned.
I like it. Keep the data. Curtis, what is your advice?
I think you have to keep the data and give your IT people the resources they need to get you the answers as fast as possible. We're starting to see in technology a lot of companies looking at things like in-memory transactions, looking at making the ability to give answers better, faster, and on an ad hoc basis rather than a pre-programmed basis. Allow the pilots, but be careful, and always remember that wonderful statement from academia. No matter how useful they may be, at their heart, all the models are still wrong.
Andrew, I want to give you the last word as our big data guru. What is the one thing that you believe that anyone dealing with big data needs to know?
I think what people need to know is that the state of the art is rather primitive, and good things will come to those who wait. If you've got a pressing need to do big data work with today's technology at its current state, then you'll have you know, good justification for doing that. But if you kind of feel like you're just doing this because it's obligatory, wait for big data technology to come to you and your skill sets and the database technology that you already have in place. Wait for it to be abstracted away so that it's easier to use. There's no need to be a pioneer unless you have a very convincing economic case for doing that. The stuff is going to get easier and easier to use. It's going to become mainstream. And at some point, we won't be calling it big data anymore. We'll just be calling it data.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. This topic is far from done. In fact, we're going to have to do further episodes on TWiET because we want to actually show big data working. This has been an overview, and we thank our panel for that. But I don't think we've quite gotten into the meat just yet. You know, it's interesting that we were talking about big data because one of the sponsors of this show actually does deal with big data. We just don't consider it big data, and that is SAP. This episode of TWiET is brought to you by Social Media Solutions from SAP. Now, if you run a regional or national enterprise, you know that there is so much data on social media, data that you need to know to be able to quantify and qualify what people feel about your brand. It's all about what one blogger is putting on his page, or what someone has put on their Facebook site and is being shared across the nation, or a tweet that is particularly funny or scathing that you need to reply to. That's why you need Social Media Solutions from SAP. See, their solution is divided into two different parts. The first is the listening component. That component searches the social web in a smart way to know what is being said about your brand. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, patterns, and even your competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of it. For example, it knows if your customers like, love, or dislike something. That helps you to build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your efforts. It also helps you identify customers who are ready to buy. It actually looks at their buying signals, their tweets, and their posts that they're sending via social media. And it uses natural language processing, or NLP, to intelligently and automatically know the differences between similar statements such as, this app has never been good, or this app has never been this good. The second part is the engaging component, and this is where the solution really becomes magical. It allows you to improve customer support by letting you set rules about which messages to route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone tweets about a technical support problem, you can automatically get it to the right person and fix their problem through social media. Social Media Solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance. If you manage the presence of a large, regional, or national enterprise, get in touch with SAP. You can find out more by going to sap.com/twit. And we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Last roundup, I do want to thank my panel here. So what are the things that people need to know about your work, about what you're doing? Let's start with you, Andrew. Thank you very much for coming on the panel. Where can people find more about big data, your stories, your analysis, your work?
Easiest way to find my work on big data would be to go to bit.ly/bigondata. That will redirect you to the Big on Data blog on ZDNet, which is the thing that I work on. We talked about Steven Sinofsky at the start of the show. I'm also very kind of focused on Microsoft technology. I'm the back page columnist for something called Visual Studio Magazine. tinyurl.com/Redmond Review will take you there. And I've recently come out with the third edition of my book on Microsoft's SQL Server database product. That's published by Microsoft Press. It's called Programming, Microsoft SQL Server 2012. Catchy title there. My company is Blue Badge Insights, and our whole business is working with Microsoft partners and Microsoft customers to help them navigate the Microsoft waters with a little more savvy. Some of that's about the politics. Some of that's about meeting the right people, understanding the strategy, and the good chunk of it is understanding the technology as well.
Well, I think our fans know that you know your stuff, so hopefully they'll stop by and take a look at your work. Curtis, what's going on in Florida? What's going on with enterprise efficiency?
Well, with enterprise efficiency, we are heading towards the end of the year. We've got some exciting E2 radio shows coming up after Thanksgiving. And the next time I will be on the road, available to see people, will be at Dell World in Austin, Texas, the week of December 10th. If anybody from the Twiat universe is going to be there, we'd love to get together with you. And in the meantime, with some of our stuff coming up, would love to get input. I've already gotten some great tweets and a couple of emails from Twiat folks. If you have gadgets or services, something that makes your life easier as you travel around and do business, we would love to know about it. Let me know. My Twitter handle is in the lower third. My email is franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com. Would love to hear from you.
Chibert, last week you were in D.C. This week you're in Florida. Next week, what, Canada? What's going on? What's going on in your life, and what do people need to know about the Geek in Paradise?
I'm just decompressing and trying to keep my wife from killing her management. That'd be nice. But I do want to encourage the viewers. There's been a big debate now at the University of Hawaii, and one of the questions came up is, gee, the football coaches can have the boosters boost their salary so that we can attract the very best. We've all seen June Jones at University of Hawaii bring the University of Hawaii to an unbeaten season. That was really cool. But we also have several Nobel laureates at the university, and we had the chance to go and boost their salaries. Oh. But the university said no, and I've been finding out that this is really, really common across the United States, even across part of Europe, that we value our sporting people, our coaches, our players, so much that we make special rules just for them. I would like our viewers to consider, gee, as much as you like those sports, science has certainly helped to make your life better. Wouldn't it be great if you helped make the scientist's life better? Think about that.
So you're all for science. And really, who could be against that? I do want to thank everyone in the Brick House for making this program possible, especially to our super TD, Jason, on the board, and to our producer, Karsten. Also, if you could, please, why not stop by our Reddit page at twiat.reddit.com. We are trying to set up our Q&A episode. We've got a few good questions there and a few more that were submitted via email, but we really want your input on what you want us to talk about this holiday season. Also, subscribe. If this is a one-time download, hopefully you've now realized that Twiat is something that you should listen to because it tells you how we're connected. You can go to our page at twit.tv/Twiat and find all the different ways you can subscribe, be it iTunes or an RSS feed, something that goes directly to your Android device, your iPad, your iPhone, or yes, even your Zune. That's right, we support the zombie Zune. Please follow me on Twitter. You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. You'll be able to see all the stories that we're going to be running in the future, our future guests, and even suggest bits for our pre-recorded segments, stuff my IT guy says, or equipment reviews that you'd like to see the Digital Jesuit do. Finally, if you are listening to us on a download, why not come and be part of the experience live? You heard me call out people in the chat room, and that's because our chat room at irc.twit.tv is filled with some of the brightest, the best and the brightest and the funniest people that you'll ever meet. It's not just a chat room, it's a temporary community. Also, you'll be able to see us film live every Monday at noon Pacific time. So why not stop by live.twit.tv? I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. This is the Twit Brick House. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiat.